Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning. How are we doing this morning? So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at wliw.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. And each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com, A-N-N-L-I-G-U-O-R-I.com, and distributed on my podcast via Audio Boom and iTunes. Well, this morning I talk U.S. Open Tennis Championship with Randy Walker, who is the publisher of a company called New Chapter Media. He publishes tennis books, and he's also the writer-editor of WorldTennisMagazine.com. I've known Randy for many, many years. We always have nice visits up in my broadcast booth at the Arthur Ashe Stadium Court at the Billie Jean King National Tennis Center, and he is just a very compelling guy. In my 43 years covering the U.S. Open, yes, I started when I was 12. I've seen this championship evolve in so many ways, good ways and bad, as the parking was a nightmare. Hopefully they can figure it out. It's just gotten, the parking's gotten so bad in the, particularly this year, but it's become such a huge event and they've added so many more, facets to the week and to the, even the qualifier week with the mixed doubles, that I just really don't think they have figured out how to accommodate all the people who are coming to the U.S. Open with parking. So it is a huge issue. But anyway, we're going to talk about some of the changes in my conversation with Randy. Randy also republished Althea Gibson's autobiography a few years ago. He republished this book that came out originally in the 60s. And it's so great that the U.S. Open has really dedicated this U.S. Open Tennis Championship to Althea Gibson, who in 1956 became the first black player to win a Grand Slam event, the French Open. Then in 1957, Althea won both Wimbledon and the U.S. Nationals, a precursor to the U.S. Open, and she won both again in 1958. So overall, Gibson won 11 Grand Slam titles, including 5 singles titles, 5 doubles titles, and 1 mixed doubles title. Many of you may not know this, but she was also the first African-American woman to compete on the Ladies Professional Golf Association, the LPGA Tour. Just an amazing woman. I talked actually to Renee Powell in her chapter in my book, Life on the Green, Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf. Renee talks about obviously knowing Althea Gibson, and even playing against Althea Gibson in a couple of tournaments when Renee Powell was a junior player. So very interesting part of golf history. I will also share a conversation I had with Megha Gane, the 21-year-old from New Jersey, who won the U.S. Women's Amateur Championship held at Bandon Dunes, which is spectacular. Venue for golf, Bandon Dunes in Oregon. And Megha Gane is a very impressive young woman on and off the course. I first met her at Augusta National, where she competed for many, many years in the drive, chip, and putt national finals. And then she still competes in the Augusta National Women's Amateur. We'll see if she competes in April, because I know she wants to turn pro after she graduates from Stanford University. So maybe she'll play one more Augusta National Women's Am before she turns pro. And hats off to U.S. Ryder Cup captain Keegan Bradley, who did not pick himself to be one of his 6 captain's picks. He announced his 6 captain's picks: Justin Thomas, Colin Morikawa, Cameron Young, Ben Griffin, Patrick Cantlay, and Sam Burns to join the 6 guys who qualified on points: Scottie Scheffler, J.J. Spahn, Xander Schauffele, Russell Henley, Harris English, and Bryson DeChambeau. I think it was a wise move for Keegan Bradley not to pick himself, even though he sat at number 11 on the Ryder Cup points standings list. There would have been way too much scrutiny on him if he played and lost too much pressure to do both play and captain. And this way, he gave another deserving player the opportunity to compete. And Keegan can focus on being the captain, which requires so much focus and attention these days. I mean, the Ryder Cup is huge, and it's just become one of the biggest international sporting events on the planet. So good move by U.S. Ryder Cup captain Keegan Bradley, who can focus on just being the captain. Enjoy this edition of Sports Interview with Ann Liguori. And the U.S. Women's Amateur was played at beautiful Bandon Dunes last week. And how exciting that New Jersey's own Mega Gane took the title. It's just the most grueling week of play and competition. And here to tell us all about it is the champion herself, Mega Gane. Hey, Micah.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on winning the U.S. Women's Amateur title. What an accomplishment. Tell us about the week.
Ooh, it's super fresh. I'm just enjoying every second that's passed since I've lifted that trophy and trying my best to respond to all the messages I've gotten, because I appreciate all the outpour of support in the last few days. Yeah, it's incredible. Dream come true.
Well, it's so grueling when you really think about the format. You have to win two rounds of stroke play. Then the 64 players with the lowest scores move on to single elimination match play. Then a series of 18-hole matches, the quarterfinals, the semifinals. And then the championship match is played over 36 holes. That is so physically and mentally draining. It must be.
Yeah, you have to beat a lot of odds along the way. I think that's what makes winning this championship so difficult, is like, it's not just three or four rounds of stroke play, but it's the format changes in the middle. You have a new opponent every day. The golf course, especially Bandon, played different from day to day, especially from stroke play to match play. So there's so many variables, and waking up every day and embracing all the challenges and playing 11 rounds of golf in that week. It is one of the most grueling things I've ever done.
Well, you look great. It doesn't look like it took too much out of you, but I know you beat three players ranked in the top 20. I remember Anna Davis from the Augusta National Women's Am, Carrie Hollenbaugh, Ayla Galitsky. Talk about some of your opponents that you beat.
Yeah. So I played Kiara's older sister in the first round, and I had never played golf with her. So that was a good match. I was up early, and then she made a little bit of a run on the back nine. So kind of got the juices flowing, was able to close that one out, I think, on the 16th or 17th hole. And I was looking ahead at the bracket, and I knew I was going to play Anna. And she's actually probably one of my closest friends out there. So I wasn't too excited about that matchup, but just reminded myself that we're both there to do a job. And she played great. She's a great competitor. I don't think I've ever like been less happy winning a match afterwards, going to hug her after the round. But she did come to watch me play in the round of 16 after that, after she lost. So, I mean, that just goes to show that her support and friendship, outweighs all the competition, which was pretty special. And then I played Carrie, who I have also never played with, and she was an incredible player. And then Ella as well. And Ella was probably one of the toughest opponents I had, if not the toughest opponent I had the whole week. I was blown away by her golf game, and I felt like I just had to grind in every single match. And by the time I made it to the final match, I felt really confident in my abilities. And I think how tough it was to get to that final match gave me a little bit of peace of mind in playing in the final.
That's right, because in that semifinal match against Ella Skaysbrook, it was an epic rally, right? You were down by what? Do you remember?
I was down four.
Down by four.
I was down four through nine, won the 10th hole, so I thought I was starting to come back. Then she won the 11th, so I was four down again. And I knew that those holes get just really windy. And I knew one advantage I had is that I had played the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th hole in my prior matches, and I knew that her matches were closing out before then because she was winning on earlier holes. So I knew I might have the upper hand of knowing how those holes play better in the wind because they are the toughest holes in the golf course. So I tried to keep that in mind and stay patient and hope for an opening. And she gave me a couple, which I was able to capitalize on, and then made some birdies and yeah, just never gave up, and a match was able to go to 19 holes.
Unbelievable. And then, as you say, you get to your championship match, 36 holes. You never trailed, but the match was tied after nine against Brooke Bierman, the Michigan State grad. What are
Yeah.
your thoughts on the on your final 36?
Yeah, the final 36 was surreal. I think that's the moment it hit me that I am playing for the title. And I let my mind wander a bit to what the outcome would be, which, probably isn't a great thing, but it worked out well in the end. And yeah, it was very tough. I definitely felt like I was in the driver's seat the whole day, but at the same time, it was never too comfortable. My biggest lead was only my own only three up, which is really nothing, and that could disappear in a moment in match play. So just never took my foot off the pedal and tried to match the birdies that Brooke started to make in the second round and was able to hold on to that lead.
And what was it like playing at Bandon Dunes? Just the surroundings are so gorgeous and inspiring. I remember playing there, and of all the courses there, Bandon Dunes was my favorite.
It's so stunning. It genuinely was heaven on earth. I was blown away in the practice rounds. I almost shed a tear during one of my stroke play rounds looking out at the ocean because I couldn't believe that this is what we get to call, like, kind of a job, and we're here in literally the best place ever. And Bandon was such a gracious host, and all the people who work there were so nice and welcoming, and they were really excited to be hosting all of the women that week. Yeah, highly recommend as a trip for anyone looking to go. I'd definitely love to go back and play the other courses there.
Yeah, it's just a special place in our own country. A lot of times you have to go to Ireland or Scotland to experience,
It doesn't really feel like it's in the US. It feels.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, you're only 21. This was your seventh U.S. women's amateur. And it took some time to learn the ropes, right, Mega? I mean, last year you got food poisoning and had to withdraw before the first round. So you paid your dues for sure.
Yeah, I feel like I have. I've played in a lot of these. That doesn't always translate to a lot of success. I feel like I've played good golf at USGA Championships before. But, never was able to play all the US juniors that I wanted. And I even got disqualified from my final one because of like a scorecard mishap. And then the USAM, a lot of first round eliminations, and then last year had to withdraw last minute. And yeah, it felt like I didn't have many like real full opportunities to give this tournament a go. And I had a good feeling going into this week, and it's probably my last one, so
Oh.
it's perfect timing.
Well, you'll be a senior, right, at Stanford?
Yes.
And so, how does your Stanford University play experience? I know the team won the 2024 NCAA title. Does that college golf experience play into your win here at the U.S.
Yeah.
Women's AM?
I mean, Stanford is a huge part of my journey so far, and I was actually at Stanford the week leading up to the AM just practicing because it is the best practice facility in the world. I think just the excellence that I'm surrounded there by for the last few years is an environment that cannot be recreated elsewhere, and something I'm really going to miss when I graduate. My teammate Paula, watching her win the British Amateur and the European Ladies Championship both in one summer, definitely raised the bar for me a little bit, and maybe gave me a little bit of extra motivation, and I'm sure everyone else on our team as well. But there's always someone doing something great in our team, which adds the best type of pressure to go out there and elevate your own game. So, I think Stanford's really cool in that way.
And I know you have a win against Lottie Wode while playing for Stanford. And as my audience knows, Lottie won her first LPGA Tour title in her very first tournament as a professional. That must have really boosted your confidence.
Yeah, I did. It was like it was a really special match. I had a lot of respect for her as an opponent, and seeing her do so well now over the summer, and knowing that my game was able to rival hers and you know just barely edge her out in the end in that match was really cool. And just playing the world number one is a really special feeling, and you look forward to days like those where you could challenge your game against the very best. And to come out with a win, especially during the national championship, was really cool. So that's been one of the highlights of my year. And yeah, she's absolutely killing it, and I hope to follow in her footsteps here, like when I turn pro.
I love that. I love that. Well, take us back. When did you first start playing golf?
I started playing golf when I was 7. My dad would take me to the driving range, and he was a pretty casual golfer. And he signed me up for different programs, and then eventually started playing golf tournaments at 8 and 9 years old, and stuck with it. I did a bunch of other sports too, but felt like golf was the one that stood out to me. And then, yeah.
And when did you meet Katie Rudolph?
Also, when I was 7,
Oh.
she spotted me on a driving range and swept me up, and I have not wanted to see what anyone else since. She's an incredible elite golf coach and has curated my golf game since the beginning. And yeah, I'm excited to continue my journey with her.
Great scout of talent. She just saw you playing out there when you were 7.
Yeah, pretty much.
I love it. Were you just a natural talented golfer, or you know, what were you hitting long balls off the tee, or what do you think made her think that you were really going to have this talent?
You know, I have no idea because I think I was shooting like 65 on 9 holes at the time. So I don't know what type of natural talent she saw in that, but I guess she had an eye for something.
I love that. Well, I first met you and Katie at the Augusta National Women's Amateur. You competed in the drive, chip, and putt national finals at Augusta National 4 times, and then the Augusta National Women's Am. What have your experience at Augusta National taught you? Because you've been there probably longer than anybody at such an early age, and to have the experience playing Augusta National in front of such a huge audience, that must have really kind of helped you learn how to play under such pressure.
Yeah, 100%. I think anyone who plays in that final round can tell you, and even in the first few rounds, that the pressure of that tournament, having to make that 30-person cut and then play a competitive round at Augusta National, that pressure is pretty crushing when you first experience it. And I haven't felt a lot like it throughout my career, and learning to get better at handling that and still playing your own golf game through all those emotions and adrenalines and highs of being at Augusta National competing for that title, has really taught me how to, best utilize my mental toolkit for other tournaments that I play. So, it's an incredible tournament, and it sets a great spotlight on a lot of really good female amateurs. And I think players and fans are alike for that tournament to take place, because it's a pretty cool week.
Well, you already said you want to turn pro. So I guess I was going to ask you, what's next for you? Would you like to play on the LPGA Tour? And if so, when do you think you would turn pro?
Yeah, that is definitely the next step. My first next step is having a great senior year at Stanford, taking in my last year of being in college, spending time with my friends, having a great fall and spring season, hopefully winning another national title for Stanford. And then after that, I will likely turn pro, but I'm going to focus on what's ahead of me first.
Yeah, you really want to have fun your senior year, and tell us what your training and your golf practice is like at Stanford. Does it consume your life? You have time, obviously, for studies. You need to at Stanford, right?
Yeah, it does not consume my life at all. I wish it would, but I have a lot of other things to do when I'm at Stanford throughout the day, like classes and work to do. So, I wish I could play more golf than I actually get to during the school year, but it all works out, and there is enough time in the day to feel like I can have it all. The social life and the school and the golf just takes a little bit of like hard work with that balance. But yeah, it's the greatest practice facility on earth, and if I could spend every minute there, I would.
And what is the key to that balance, would you say, Megas? As young girls look up to you and think, how does she do that? How can she play such great golf and do well in her studies and have a healthy social life? What is the key to balancing all that?
I think the key is definitely that not trying to do all three at the same time, prioritizing one bucket or two at a time, you know, whether that's day to day or week to week, or even if you just want to dedicate 1 month to, I want to put golf on the back burner and just think about my real life for a bit, or the other way around. You know, checking in with yourself and being like, what do I need right now and what do I want so I can actually maximize whatever it is that I want to focus on, whether it's a couple of classes or my short game. Because you're never gonna have it all the time, because that's just impossible. But I think like learning to fill those buckets week in, week out, seeing what you need. And then that's how I strike a balance.
And what can you tell us, Mega, about the depth of talent, the level of competition out there among the college golfers? The competition seems to get stiffer and stiffer by the moment, from what I see, but you're in it. So, how do you view it from perhaps your even before you became a freshman at Stanford and now, as far as the level of the game in college golf?
Yeah, it's getting ridiculous, which is a really good thing. That's what you want. You want to be you want people to bring out your absolute best, and you want the best competition. Girls are hitting it farther and farther every year, which has motivated me to try to become a longer hitter. I mean, the scores just get lower at tournaments, and I think there's so many more players shooting lower scores. And even if you look at this year's Augusta National Women's Amateur, and there was so many, every single player who made the cut was under par, which is unheard of. And after two rounds, you had to be at least five, six, seven, eight under to be in contention. So I think it's just a new level that we're all bringing out in each other, and the future of women's golf is definitely very bright. And I think we're seeing that with you know, Lottie right off the bat, I think is a great representative of the best of our college players going out and making that next step, and even seeing you know, Maya Stark win the US Open was really cool because she's in our age range as well. So yeah, I'm excited for everything to come for college golf talents to be on display.
Well, what a title to have on your resume, U.S. Women's Amateur Champion. And that trophy is gorgeous, isn't it? It's just so ornate and so beautiful.
Yeah, it is gorgeous. I'm stalking the tracking number on that to my house to see when it's arriving. I'm excited to look at it every day.
Well, all of New York, the Met Golf section is very proud of you. New Jersey, the Stanford, the entire country. Congratulations, Mega Gane. Continued success.
Thank you so much, Anne.
Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori. I am sitting in the broadcast booth here where I've been many, 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 many years, too many years to promote. Looking over the Arthur Ashe Stadium court here at the Billie Jean King National Tennis Center, U.S. Open 2025. And it is my pleasure to say hello to Randy Walker, who I've known for so many years, who has covered U.S. Open since 1992 and has been here even longer as a kid coming to watch as a fan. But Randy is the publisher of New Chapter Media. He's a writer, editor of WorldTennisMagazine.com. And if you want to know a statistic or really anything about the history of this game, Randy Walker is a good person to talk to. Welcome to Sports Interview.
Thank you, Anne. I have great memories with you back in the old Louis Armstrong Stadium when we were in the top rafters there at the press box. So it's great. This is the second rafters of stadiums here, Arthur Ashe Stadium and Louis Armstrong. So pleasure to be here.
You know, I was talking, I did a post on Instagram and Facebook on, you know, being my covering what 43 U.S. Opens, and before this stadium, the Ashe Stadium was built back in 97, and opened, we were at the Louis Armstrong. We were on in this little, like, press box that seemed to be made out of aluminum. And it was so tight and so small. And they did not ban smoking back in the day. And so guys were smoking, and I was writing scripts by hand before laptops and going on the air on ABC Radio Network and then WFAN every 20 minutes. It was just crazy to think about those days. The elevator rarely worked getting us up there. And then there was a hailstorm. I don't know if you were here then, Randy, but there was a tornado one year during the Open, and the hail just pummeled, you know, this press box. And because it was aluminum, you know, it was so noisy. So, oh my goodness, the memories of being here so many years.
You know, and that press box in that stadium didn't just rock from thunderstorms and hailstorms, but when Jimmy Connors was rolling there in that run to the semifinals in 1991, and, you know, Jimmy had this place rocking. So, you know, as, you know, this place has rocked with, you know, Serena Williams back in the day, and, you know, nowadays with, you know, Carlos Alcaraz and Jannik Sinner and the whole group of the new generation of players.
So, yeah, there's just so much to talk about. And being here as many years as you've been here, before we get into Althea Gibson, because I know you republished her book, I Always Wanted to Be Somebody. I want to talk a lot about Althea. But before we get into that, what are the biggest changes that you've noticed here at the Tennis Center since really you started covering this years ago?
Well, I mean, I can remember, you know, my first Open as a fan was 1979, and the tournament was primarily a day event, and people would come for the day, you know, they'd drive in from Connecticut and New York, and et cetera, and it was a day event, and the night sessions were kind of like, you know, just an extra session, et cetera. But nowadays, the night sessions are out of control with the lights and the, you know, jumbotrons and the music, and you got the, you know, kiss cam and everything. I mean, it's just totally electric here at night. It's almost half tennis tournament, half rock concert. You know, so that's, I've seen the biggest change over the years. And, you know, the USTA has done such a great job getting the kind of non-tennis fan here. You know, it used to be just everybody would come from their tennis club and they'd wear their tennis, you know, outfits and their tennis sneakers and so forth. But, you know, through the decades, they've done a great job to make this just a major sporting event and getting sports fans, not just tennis fans here, and even just people who are not sports fans who just want to come for the spectacle of coming for the U.S. Open, get their honeydews, get their T-shirt, get their hat. And, you know, that's what I've seen over the years.
It has expanded in so many different ways, but mostly in attendance. And they have elongated this championship. It seems to be going on a month now. Before it was 14 days. But talk about how they expanded just the actual competition and the days where they can sell tickets and bring more people in as spectators.
Well, the U.S. Open used to be a two-week tournament. It used to be one Monday, and then it would end on the second Sunday. And, you know, it was kind of the best-kept secret in tennis was that the qualifying rounds are the week before the Open and that it was free. And it was just kind of an insider secret. But the USTA started to embrace the qualifying. I mean, the level of play in the qualifying rounds is out of control, awesome. And, you know, here we are on, you know, the day four of the Open, and there's qualifiers. Players who are playing in the qualifying are winning matches against seeded players today. So you have high-quality players playing in the qualifying round. So the USTA has embraced that, and they have branded it Fan Week. So you have the qualifying rounds. You have all the vending areas open. You got the food court open. You can come for the qualifying and get a honeydew. So you can get a T-shirt, etc. And it's free. It's free to the public Monday through you know, through the start of the main draw. And then the USTA would also kind of throw in some exhibition matches at night. You could come watch the stars practice, et cetera. And what the USTA did this year was twofold. They started the tournament on a third Sunday. So the tournament now goes 15 days, where it used to be 14 days. So you get that extra weekend day where you can come to the U.S. Open, which is great for fans because they don't have to skip work. Another weekend day to come out and watch the tennis. And then what the USTA did was they moved the mixed doubles tournament from basically the second week, which was kind of an afterthought, and they held it now the week before during the qualifying week. So now this is full-fledged a three-week tournament. And the mixed doubles, it was the first time this year, and they held it at night. They were able to sell tickets. They sold out both nights. You had 25,000 people here each night. So that was a massive success, and I think the USTA will kind of grow on that. So attention, everybody, the U.S. Open, this is a three-week event.
I said almost 4 weeks because it seems like that long. I mean, my goodness, I came up out here to pick up my credential last week before the first week of singles main draw play. It was packed. As you say, there were I read where there were 78,000 people here for the mixed doubles championship. And I think it was a great idea to do that because with the popularity of the game, seemingly at an all-time high, you have all these great singles champions, both men and women, you know, partnering up. And people want to see that side. People want to see, you know, the top players playing together in mixed, I think. I think it's a big draw, and there's a lot of interest there.
It's really one of the big underutilized assets in tennis in that you can have men and women playing on the same court in mixed doubles. I mean, this has been going on as long as the U.S. Championships has been held, you know, since, you know, the 1880s. But, yeah, it's fun when you see Iga Swiatek and Casper Ruud and Jack Draper and Jessica Pegula. Venus Williams was out there playing with Riley Opelka of the 148 mile per hour serve. And, you know, I got a chuckle of seeing Riley Opelka serve 148 mile per hour serves to women and acing them at will. That really is one of the most underutilized things. I mean, Billie Jean King has been promoting that for years, is that mixed doubles, this is what, this is a great asset for tennis. And, you know, you just, based on how the schedule was, where you had it in the second week and it was on the outer courts and the lesser players would only be playing it because the main players, there's so much money on the line that they wanted to concentrate on the singles. But the USTA flipped the script and they played it the week before, so it wouldn't really infringe upon the singles players playing in their main priority, which is winning the singles tournament. So this way they could have it, and the players could concentrate on the mixed doubles, then have some rest, and then concentrate on the singles. So massive success, amazing entertainment, and it's going to be interesting to see if the other Grand Slams are going to copy this format and have the mixed doubles first the week before the start of the singles tournament.
All right, so this U.S. Open is honoring Althea Gibson, and you had the foresight to republish the book that she wrote back in the 60s called Althea Gibson, I Always Wanted to Be Somebody, From the Streets of Harlem to the Championship of the World, with a foreword by Billie Jean King. Really, Randy, so great that you did that, because I feel that Althea Gibson for many, many years went so under-recognized. I thought the same thing about Billie Jean King back in the day, and then they named it the Billie Jean King National Tennis Center, and she has just gone, just flown with publicity and with what she continues to contribute to not only tennis, but to, women's sports overall. And do you think now Althea Gibson is getting more recognition? Is she getting the recognition that she so deserves?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the USTA in 2019, they dedicated a statue for Althea Gibson here at the USTA Billie Jean King National Tennis Center. And that's where the genesis of this project happened, because I saw an interview with Billie Jean, a television interview, where she said, Althea was my shero, and as a child, I went to bed with her book, I Always Wanted to Be Somebody, under my pillow. And I heard this interview, and I was like, wow, I got to get that book. So I went to Amazon and eBay, and you could only buy used copies of the book from, 60 years earlier for $300. And I thought, that's a crime. I mean, Althea Gibson's autobiography, that needs to be available to the masses, and it shouldn't be, only available for $300. So I was like, I'm going to republish this. I run a publishing company, New Chapter Media, And I immediately contacted the Althea Gibson's second cousin, Don Felder, and also Michelle Curry, who runs the Althea Gibson Estate and the Althea Gibson Community Tennis Association. I said, hey, can we do this? Can we publish this? So we can have fans learn about Althea's story in her own words, and fans don't have to spend $300 for the book, that we can just make it available for, you know, regular retail price, you know, $10 on Kindle, $19.95 for a paperback. So we republished the book in 2021, and Billie Jean King, of course, agreed to write, you know, the new foreword to the book, and it's just a fascinating story about her life and the trials and tribulations and the challenges that she faced as a black woman in the 1940s and 1950s and to her triumphs at Wimbledon and the U.S. Open to become one of the all-time great figures in sports and society. You know, the thing that people don't know about Althea, or a lot of people don't know about Althea, she broke the color barrier in tennis. She also, Anne, with your golf background, she was the first black player to play a professional women's golf.
I know that, and I wrote that in my book, Life on the Green, Lessons and Wisdom from Legends of Golf, in the chapter that I did with Renee Powell, on Renee Powell. Renee was not the first African-American female on the LPGA. It was Althea Gibson, and we talk about that in that very chapter.
I mean, she was just such an amazing talent. And the other thing, which I think still doesn't get recognized, is that she was an amazing singer. I mean, you go to YouTube and Google Althea Gibson Sings, and her music is on YouTube. I mean, like, she could have been at the top of the charts. I mean, I'm not sure where that kind of music went and so forth, but she's an amazing singer. I mean, just the talent that this woman had was outstanding. To be a professional, top flight golfer, tennis player, and singer, amazing.
In Billie Jean King's foreword in Althea Gibson, I Always Wanted to Be Somebody, she writes, Althea was our Jackie Robinson of tennis, and the barriers show broke down, and the doors she opened have paved the way for generations of tennis players. Her contributions to our sport and to our world are many. Without Althea, there may not have been an Arthur Ashe, Leslie Allen, Zena Garrison, James Blake, Chandra Rubin, Mel Washington, Venus Williams, Serena Williams, Coco Gauff, Frances Tiafoe, or Naomi Osaka. If you can see it, you can be it.
You know, and I think that also, the name that you mentioned there that I think also means a lot is Venus Williams. And, Venus Williams coming through the first ever edition of the U.S. Open in Arthur Ashe Stadium was 1997, and she got to the final at 17 years old. And the influence that she had was outstanding to all the African-American players on the women's tour.
Yes, and to see Venus the other night playing here at the age of 45 in the singles draw, she got a wild card entry, as you know, Randy Walker, competing in her 25th U.S. Open, the most of anybody, male or female, in the Open era. I mean, I had to stay for that match. And she took a set. She lost in three, but incredible what Venus Williams has done. And for her to be playing still, and she's in the women's doubles as well.
Well, I mean, she's 45 years old, and she's still competitive. I mean, she nearly beat the number 11 seed, Carolina Muhova. So, I mean, some people have kind of criticized, like, oh, you know, she's 45 years old, you shouldn't be giving her a wild card. But she's inspired more tennis players than any tennis coach in the world. And for her to be able to play here at the U.S. Open and play well, she can inspire another generation of players and black players. And, I think she can also inspire players to want to play to a later age because she's 45 years old and she's still playing great. So I think she's just an inspiration to many people on many different levels.
We are talking to Randy Walker, publisher, New Chapter Media. He also contributes as a writer and editor to WorldTennisMagazine.com. And I'm just thrilled that he republished Althea Gibson's book. It's just so, so wonderful to have access to this. How do people get a copy of this book? I Always Wanted to Be Somebody.
Well, Amazon.com for sure. That's the easiest way. And, you know, basically wherever books are sold, you can go to New Chapter Media too, newchaptermedia.com as well. And check out all my other tennis books out there too. So if you're a tennis fan, you go to that website. You can get some great, great reads. And you'll become a smarter tennis fan by reading these books. So you can show off to all your friends and all your tennis knowledge by reading the books I published.
I love Randy's enthusiasm for this game. I know he's also a golfer, but he puts on a charity golf event in Vero Beach for Marty Fish's foundation, right? And you've been here at this U.S. Open. You normally come during the qualifying week. What have been some of your observations so far in this championship?
Well, I mean, it's still early. I mean, I think for the men, I mean, it's really going to be Carlos Alcaraz and Jannik Sinner. I mean, you asked me before, who do you think is going to win the men's tournament? I said, well, you know, Carlos Alcaraz on one side of the coin and Jannik Sinner on the other side of the coin, flip the coin. But the women's event is a lot more wide open. I mean, you have a lot more upsets. You have a lot more players in contention. You got Coco Gauff, who won the French Open. You got, well, Madison Keys was the Australian Open champion. She lost in the first round here. That just kind of shows you, you know, the wide variety of talent on the women's game. And Iga Swiatek, who won Wimbledon. And then you have the defending champion, Arina Sabalenka. You know, so I think the women's tournament is a lot more wide open, a lot more exciting. You know, you're going to see the draws really wide open on the women's side. But the men, I think it's basically those two guys, the new two, as they're talked about, you know, to take over from the new generation of Novak Djokovic, Rafael Nadal, and Roger Federer. And, you know, Novak, he's still in there. He's age 38. And, you know, he's still plugging away. And, you know, he's still a threat to win this tournament. I mean, the guy's won 24 major championships, looking for number 25. So, you know, certainly don't count him out. But, you know, for the first week of the tournament, you know, I love the first week of the tournament because you really have these amazing stories on the outer courts. And a player that plays in the first round on, you know, court 12, you know, they may win a first round match. And that might be their career highlight or the biggest match they've ever had in their career. Or you're seeing a career blossom in front of your eyes. And that's, you know, equally exciting, almost as equally exciting as watching a player win, you know, a semifinal, a quarterfinal, or a final. So, you know, the outer courts, that's really, you know, for the first week, for all those tennis connoisseurs, you know, those the people that that really follow the game intently, that's really the place to be for the first week of the tournament. And, you know, of course, the night sessions to see the stars and all that. But that's what I like to do. And I've been covering that on my worldtennismagazine.com website. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, the work in Vero Beach with the charity golf tournament for Marty Fish Foundation. We also host a $15,000 futures level tournament, which is, you know, single A baseball for tennis. It's the lowest level of professional tennis. But we've had in the recent years, we've had Ben Shelton play our tournament, Tommy Paul play our tournament, Francis Tiafoe play our tournament. And this is where they get their first ATP points, their first paychecks, which are usually sometimes only a couple hundred dollars. That level of tennis is exciting. And I love running that tournament that benefits the Marty Fish Children's Foundation, and to get to meet these star players when they're just starting out, and that's a lot of fun.
Marty Fish, I always say his name when it comes to celebrity golf. He's always winning these celebrity golf tournaments. Getting back to the women's singles draw for a second, and then we'll go to the men's, Randy Walker. You know, I was surprised Madison Keys lost. I mean, she won the Australian Open. She beat Sabalenka in that final. That final was just dazzling. She played a flawless tennis, I thought, in that women's single. But she, I think she had maybe a thigh issue. Is that what I read? It slowed her down a little bit again in her first round match. But disappointing that top American is out of the women's singles draw already.
Well, Madison, she you know, didn't play a great match. You know, she really felt the pressure. You know, she was very nervous. And I think that's what a lot of Americans sometimes feel here at the U.S. Open when there's so much expectations on them playing on Ash Stadium as a Grand Slam champion. And she was, you know, she was supposed to win. And I think everybody can relate to any sport. If you're playing a match and you're expected to win against a player, you have that little extra pressure on you. And, you know, sometimes that can fool with your mind a little bit. And also, if the player that you're playing against is playing well and you're not playing well and you're expected to win, and you can play mind games with them. So, you know, that happens. You know, there's a lot of great players on the women's tour, and this Zarazuza woman from Mexico played a great match, and Madison didn't play well, felt the pressure, and, you know, that's why we watch sports, right? We don't know what's going to happen. So that's, you know, that's what happened. It was an upset, and those happen.
Sabalenka, she is the top seed defending champion. I think it will be her against Swiatek in the final. I mean, that's a long-term prediction. We have plenty of tennis to go. But those two really, well, Swiatek won won Wimbledon this year. I'm sure Sabalenka is just primed to try to win a major this year. She's just such a powerful, strong player.
Well, you know, I mean, like, there's the pressure. You know, this is kind of the end of the year. This is the, you know, the PGA Championship used to have the moniker "Glory's Last Shot." You know, where it's like, this is the last chance you have to, you know, get your the major tournament, and that's what Sabalenka's feeling, because this is Glory's last shot for her. It's if she doesn't win the U.S. Open and doesn't win a major this year, she's going to kind of feel like this season, you know, got away from her. She's the number one player in the world. She's been very dominant, you know, and she's lost in the finals of the French Open. She lost in the finals of the Australian Open, where she was expected to win both those finals. She lost in the semifinals of Wimbledon. So she's kind of feeling like she's got to win this tournament. So that can either be, you know, extra motivating for her, or it adds a little bit of pressure for her. So, you know, that's why we come out and watch. But Iga has been playing amazing tennis since Wimbledon. She had a terrible first half of the year, lost her number one ranking. She dropped to number 7 in the world, which for her is, you know, kind of unheard of. And, you know, now she's kind of seen as the favorite because she won Wimbledon. As you remember, and she won the Wimbledon final 6-0, 6-0, which, you know, a lot of us hackers can relate to, losing matches 6-0, 6-0. And
for a final, please. That's so embarrassing. And not a really strong statement for women's tennis, may I add.
Well, it doesn't happen very often. I mean, it did happen in the, you know, Steffi Graf won the 1988 French Open 6-0. So, but it can happen. You know, I mean, Jimmy Connors won, you know, the U.S. Open in 1974, I think, like 6-0, 6-1, 6-1, you know, and the 74 Wimbledon final, both times beating Ken Rosewall super convincingly. So it can happen. But Iga, a lot of people are saying she's the favorite now because of her Wimbledon victory, and she's back in form. And she won the tournament in Cincinnati, which was the big hardcore tournament leading into the U.S. Open, and she played great there. So she's kind of seen as the favorite, and I like your prediction that it'll be Sabalenka and Iga in the final.
And who would you pick of those two to win it all?
I think that would be a coin flip. I mean, that's why we come out to watch, right? We want to come out to watch to see what happens. You never know what's going to happen.
All right, the men's. I love that diplomacy you showed there, Randy Walker. The men's, as you say, Alcaraz won the French. Sinner, defending champion, won Wimbledon, won Australian. Sinner is seated number one here. Carlos Alcaraz is seated number two. I have to say, those two, what a rivalry that's really going to become when you look at all the all-time rivalries in tennis through the years. These two we're going to see in the finals, I think, for a long, long time. What are your thoughts about these two incredible male players?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, they played in the Roland Garros final in Paris, one of the greatest matches of all time. You know, I published a book written by Steve Flink, who's an International Tennis Hall of Famer, and the book is called The Greatest Tennis Matches of All Time, which talks about the Borg, McEnroe, you know, Graf, Selys, you know, Everett, Navratilova, etc. And I immediately emailed Steve after that Sinner Alcaraz final and said, you know, we may have to add a chapter to a new edition of the book. But, you know, one of the interesting things about Sinner is that he won the Australian Open, he won Wimbledon, and he had match points in that final against Carlos Alcaraz. And had he converted one of those match points that he had, he could have won the French Open, hypothetically still won Wimbledon, and he'd be going for a grand slam here at the U.S. Open. Of course, this is all hypothetical, but that's kind of something interesting that, you know, history buffs and tennis aficionados can, you know, debate. You know, I think it'll be certainly them in the final this year, and they're going to be playing many finals in the years to come. And let's see if somebody can rise up and challenge to beat them. You know, the Federer and Nadal and Djokovic, they dominated tennis for so many years with a little bit of Andy Murray, a little bit of Stan Wawrinka, but nobody really could touch them. And it'll be interesting to see if somebody could touch Alcaraz and Sinner. I hope some players do, because you don't really want to see two guys just dominate all the time. So it'd be great to see someone else step up.
I love the fact that Novak Djokovic keeps going strong. He has 24 major titles tied with Margaret Court. He needs one more to break the all-time record. What are your thoughts about Novak at this point, physically and mentally, and what are his chances at this event?
Well, you'd never count out Novak Djokovic. I mean, he's won 24 majors, and he's been doubted so many times in his career. So, you know, certainly don't want to start doubting him now. But he is 38, and as they say, father time is undefeated. So we'll see. But if the – I mean, he could probably beat everybody. I mean, people say he could beat everybody in the draw except Sinner and Alcaraz. I mean, obviously Novak being the champion is. He thinks he can beat, you know, anybody. But the experts say, you know, those are the only two guys that – you know, really he can't beat, although he doesn't want to hear that. But you never know, draws open up. I mean, what happens if somebody gets sick?
He's in the bottom half of the draw, by the way, where Alcaraz is.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, what happens if Alcaraz gets upset, you know? And then what happens if Sinner, I mean, he may be able to win the tournament without having to play those two. I mean, you never know. That's why we watch, and that's why it's sports. It's not, you know, guaranteed. So, you know, I wouldn't count him out, but, you know, like I said, father time is undefeated. He's only got a few more, you know, years left in him probably. And, you know, I think for him, it's also going to be motivation. You know, is he motivated to get out here and play, you know, these tournaments and play against these young guys? So, you know, we'll see also with his fitness. And, you know, he's 38. He's in amazing shape. But let's see if he's able to play 3 out of 5 set matches over 2 weeks, you know, winning seven matches to win the championship.
Last question, Randy Walker. All your years here, what is your most memorable U.S. Open memory?
Wow, there are a lot of them, but I will say one of the more recent ones is from sitting here right next to you when we were watching Serena Williams play her last tournament here at the U.S. Open. And I don't think this place has rocked more than when Serena was playing those last couple matches, and the screaming and the fans and the excitement. And I have so many memories, but that's one that I'll never forget. And also the year that she played Bianca Andreescu. I was also sitting here next to you in the final. And when she was making that furious comeback in the third set and almost came back in the third set to win that match. And this place was rocking. And, you know, of my recent memories, those are the memories that I remember the most, when Serena had this place rocking. So,
well, I'm delighted to hear that sitting next to me was your most memorable moment. But honestly, the things that I've witnessed from this broadcast booth perched atop Arthur Ashe Stadium court has just been throughout, what, 43 years of my covering this championship has been very, very special. And I feel very blessed. And Randy, I'm so grateful that you come up and visit every year. It's always wonderful to reconnect with you. I so admire your work and your passion for tennis. Continued success. And thanks again for being on Sports Interview.
All the best, Ann. Thanks for having me again.
My thanks to Mega Gane, to Randy Walker, and to My Good Sound Production. As Samuel Goldwyn once said, I'm a great believer in luck, and I find the harder I work, the more I have of it. I love that quote. Have a great day. Be safe, be kind. And I look forward to talking with you next time on Sports Interview with Ann LaGorie.